You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 18 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
I'm Tristan Caracino. And this week we finally get to play some football.
Well, I think there was some football previously.
We finally get to play some football.
I mean, there was like 17 weeks of it.
So we're really excited and want to dive right into talking about the Seahawks versus the Saints. This is kind of the moment we've been leading to all season and finally playing a playoff game. Everything that we've done is built to this and really want to get into it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really dating back to last year in Atlanta, the end of that game, that Matt Bryant's field goal, it's all been the excitement of getting back to this point and hopefully being in position where the Seahawks have home field advantage and are playing these games at home. And lo and behold, that's the opportunity they have in front of them starting Saturday.
Literally, this is the moment that I've been waiting for since January of 2013. It's been one full year.
Again, you know, having your child go through major milestones, start walking, start talking, really not that relevant compared to the Seahawks.
Well, this is a big deal. People have babies all the time. You don't have home field throughout the playoffs that often.
That's true, only the second time in franchise history.
So let's talk about more generally. So they're playing the Saints, and the Saints are one of the teams that I call the Fateful Four. They're kind of the teams who have been competing with each other throughout the season. All of them played each other, some of them twice. The two NFC South teams, the Saints and the Panthers, and the two NFC West teams, the 49ers and the Seahawks. The Seahawks are, everybody's played each other, and the Seahawks have the best record against those teams. They're the only one who's 3-1, and the 49ers are 1-3. The other two have split. They're both 2-2.
Yeah, it was kind of a double round robin for the teams within their same divisions, and then a single round robin with the teams in the opposite division.
It's kind of something where it's felt like these are the four teams who will be playing each other in the playoffs all season. This is what we've been going toward, and actually it came out this way. And some of the pretenders were knocked out in the first round.
I would say the Philadelphia Eagles felt differently about that.
Well, the two teams who were knocked out were the teams who are not part of the Fateful Four, and teams that the Seahawks hadn't played, and most of these teams hadn't played. And I think that they all have a lot of similarities. The Saints are the one team who I'd consider probably an offensive team. I'm doing air quotes there. Probably an offensive team.
That translates really well.
But have actually a pretty good defense. And the other three are built really similarly. I was thinking how previously we talked about how the Panthers are like the Seahawks of last year. And now I was thinking about how the 49ers are like the Seahawks of last year. How they were the better team going into the road against probably the worst playoff team. And won a fairly close game, and they're coming in with so much confidence that they're actually favored in a road game right now.
Yeah, it is a similar situation, and you know these two teams, both really good, stuck in the same division where one of them is going to be get the bye, and one of them is going to be forced to play on the road at least two times. Although now the 49ers are getting all excited about the possibility of playing a final game at Candlestick Park next week.
They're feeling very confident. And it was something, weirdly, I felt confident about this last year in the playoffs. I was like, I think there's a chance of this happening.
And it didn't.
It didn't. The Seahawks lost to the Falcons. And it's been a full year that we've been moving toward this point. But the Saints, per Football Outsiders' weighted DVOA, which came out today, are the worst NFC team remaining after the Packers have been knocked out. And the Packers clearly were not meant to be in the playoffs. it was a close game that they played with the 49ers, but they were not up to the level of the other NFC playoff teams.
I mean, I think that's a little dismissive of what they've done with Aaron Rodgers in the lineup. But yeah, like we talked about last week, defensively, they're not on a par with, you know, with even Philadelphia and with certainly New Orleans, the two offensive teams, and then way out of the league with Carolina, San Francisco, and Seattle.
Well, if you look at the team's bye weighted DVOA, which emphasizes the end of the season, it basically throws out the first 4 weeks and really diminishes the quality of the second quarter of the season. If you look at those teams' bye weighted DVOA, the Green Bay Packers are number 26. And then from there, the second lowest playoff team is the Indianapolis Colts, who won last week, are at 16. They're the lowest overall team, and San Diego and Indianapolis are below New Orleans. But New Orleans is left as the lowest NFC team right now.
But not a huge separation between the other three teams in the NFC. And we talked last week about kind of who we were most scared of facing, who we wanted to face. And you actually were interested in facing the Saints, but I think you reevaluated that position.
I did, and determined that I was more interested in facing the Packers, which obviously wasn't going to happen after that Saturday. But I still feel like, of the teams remaining now, the Saints are the team who I want to be playing. Basically, the Saints vis-a-vis the 49ers, I much rather would want to be playing the Saints.
Well, it's a stylistic issue for me, in part. I mean, you know, the teams, Carolina and San Francisco, playing a similar style. It's going to be a low-scoring game where potentially one big play could swing things, whereas I feel like against New Orleans, you've potentially got more of an opportunity to open things up.
It's true. I mean, it's kind of strange looking at the Football Outsiders DVOA, because New Orleans actually ranks ahead of San Francisco in that category defensively. They're number 5 offensively, number 10 defensively. The place where San Francisco and New Orleans really look to be separate is San Francisco has the number 5 special teams, and New Orleans has the number 26 special teams. And we'll talk about that more, how it'll affect this game in a little bit, but it's one place where, in the playoffs in general, it seems to be that having really good special teams really helps you out. The places where you want to be good are defensively and special teams, and the Seahawks rank 1st and 6th respectively there.
And they're the odd team out of that fateful 4, everybody else in the top 12 in special teams.
So do we want to dive into talking about the Saints more specifically?
I think so. So let's start with when the Saints have the football?
When the Saints have the football.
Okay, so...
And obviously we'll be referring back to the Monday night game that they played in Seattle on December 2nd quite a bit. I know that Pete Carroll said that we should basically throw that out, but want to look at trends that came out of that game and how things may be different from that, how players were defended, and what's going to be different about this upcoming game.
Yeah, I think it's a starting point. So I did the NFL Game Rewind free trial on NFL.com and went through and watched the entire game and charted it a little bit today. So one of the big things I wanted to look at is how the Seahawks defended Jimmy Graham. Mm-hmm. Obviously, one of the most dangerous targets in the NFL is a receiver with his size and strength and speed. And the Seahawks really defended him by committee in that Monday night game. You know, I didn't chart every play. Sometimes it's a little difficult to tell without going to the all-22 angles. But, you know, I had 6 different players assigned to him at least once in that game. Both all 3 starting linebackers, plus Cam Chancellor, and then also Byron Maxwell and Richard Sherman is cornerbacks when he was split out wide. Maxwell and Sherman 4 times apiece, and then the only guy he caught a pass against when he was assigned one-on-one was Maxwell. He had a 20-yard catch against 1 of 2. Chancellor, he was targeted once, incomplete. And then 6 of his 9 targets I had coming against when the Seahawks were in zone coverage. I mean, again, that's a little difficult to tell, especially as a layman. But
So do you think they're more likely to throw to Jimmy Graham if the Seahawks are in zone?
That was the scenario. He had a very difficult time beating the Seahawks man coverage, which is kind of surprising. I mean, you put a linebacker one-on-one with Jimmy Graham, and obviously there was help, but you'd expect that to be a very favorable situation. But the Seahawks linebackers did a terrific job of keeping up with him. They weren't victimized at all. So he did have a touchdown where it was kind of unclear whether it was a zone. He had a little 2-yard touchdown before mm-hmm. Bobby Wagner could really get up to him. And it looked like it was probably a zone, but it could have been man coverage. And then he also had a 20-yard catch against zone coverage. But there were only 2 of 6 throwing the ball to him against the zone.
What was the impact? And obviously the Seahawks will be without K.J. Wright this week. What was the impact that K.J. Wright had in that game, particularly against Jimmy Graham?
Well, I think one of the big things that gets pointed out is his size is useful. He's much taller than Malcolm Smith, who's going to step in for him, who's only 6 foot. And that's a big asset in those matchups, especially trying to play the ball in the air.
That's interesting. And I thought it was also interesting, Earl Thomas never defended against Jimmy Graham in that game.
And that's not really what the Seahawks do with Earl Thomas. He's sitting back as the, you know, zone man in a cover one.
Playing deep
in center field. The other thing we saw was the Saints changed up how they used Graham a little bit in the second half. Now, how much this had to do with the score of the game, I don't know. But they started using him both on the line a little bit more as a traditional tight end, which generally they don't. They use him much more like a wide receiver. But we also didn't see him, you know, basically matched up one-on-one with a cornerback as much in the second half. They started using him in bunch formations. So I think that's where they were trying to create that zone coverage and get him opportunities to break free.
And so typically you would expect that the Saints want Jimmy Graham matched up one-on-one with a quarterback unless his name is Aqib Talib.
Or Richard Sherman.
Because of the size that he's going to have versus those defenders. But in this situation, you think that the Saints had to change what they were doing because of how well the Seahawks were defending him?
Yeah, I mean, Sherman, he wasn't even thrown out one time, and I have them matched up four times. And he did beat Maxwell the one time, but it wasn't necessarily a matchup they looked to get a whole bunch. And there were a couple of times where you might have a Trips bunch set on one side of the formation and then Graham all by himself on the other side. And what that does is it makes it really difficult to give safety help for the Seahawks. It's basically a one-on-one coverage. But again, that's a situation where the Seahawks, I think, feel pretty confident in their corners holding up.
And the corners in this game, so this is the first game that Byron Maxwell was starting after the Walter Thurman suspension. Browner was hurt previously. So this was the first game that he was playing on his own with Jeremy Lane mostly in the nickel. And Maxwell had such a great game there. And we'll talk about this when we talk about the wide receivers. But they didn't really target Maxwell in much of any specific way, assuming that he's not going to have that kind of experience. And I wonder, they clearly respected him there. And I wonder if they'll look to get Jimmy Graham on Maxwell this coming week or look for him versus linebackers.
Yeah, I guess the question you have is how much of that is we're going to do what we do well as opposed to, you know, that they respected him enough to think he'd do a good job. So maybe it's a little bit different in this scenario where your game plan changes probably more week to week, I think, in the playoffs. But Maxwell also had he did have a good game. He deflected a pass away in the end zone. And he's been pretty strong ever since he's moved into the starting lineup.
And then what about moving to the biggest Saints asset, Drew Brees? In that game against the Seahawks, he was 0 for 8 on deep throws, something that couldn't have happened for the rest of the season where they didn't hit one deep throw. And then 23 for 30 on short throws for 142 yards. So he was obviously checking down a lot during that game.
He maybe missed a deep throw or two. There was one pass to Josh Hill, their third tight end, that sailed a little bit and gave Chancellor a chance to come over and jar the ball away on what could have been a big play. But really, there wasn't much there. And it seemed like those checkdowns were largely by design because they didn't necessarily want to expose Brees to the Seahawks pass rush.
So you think that they were very immediately checking down? They weren't even looking downfield?
Yeah, it was pretty quickly. I mean, you know, if there wasn't a read open right away, that's when he was checking down. And that's where the Seahawks linebackers, again, were crucial. You know, a lot of Darren Sproles can be very effective coming out of the backfield in that role, and he had a very quiet day.
I wonder if that's something that they'll try to do differently this week, really forcing throws downfield to pressure those defenders down there. I mean, having only 8 throws deep is something, but not completing any of them means that you're probably not going to keep trying to force it.
It was especially surprising because they were in a situation where you'd probably want to force the deep ball because they fell behind so much early on in the game. But that's obviously a very dangerous situation against the Seahawks. We've seen it time and time again where you start forcing those throws, and that's when the Seahawks start coming up with picks.
I mean, they clearly were trying to limit the turnovers there, and Brees didn't have any picks during the game. It was a fumble that was returned for a touchdown by Michael Bennett, correct?
It was technically an interception, but it was a pass that, Avril deflected out of his hand, so effectively it was a fumble.
That's right. Pro Football Reference doesn't have it as an interception.
That may have been up to the scorers on how they ruled that, but either way.
But I do think that Brees, of all of the elite quarterbacks, is probably the one quarterback who's most willing to force throws at times and who can miss throws, and I think that'll be a big factor in this game coming up. It was something where they checked down so much that the Seahawks defense didn't get to have the kind of impact there that it would have liked to. It had the impact in stopping these passes, stopping the long passes, and really tackling players very quickly.
Yeah.
I think that's something that gets underrated is he had a high completion percentage, but there were no broken tackles. And that's a place where you really have to credit the linebackers and also credit players like Richard Sherman, Cam Chancellor, and just their tackling ability. And because they're going against some pretty slippery players like Darren Sproles, like Jimmy Graham, and just bringing them down immediately on contact.
The other thing I wonder about is whether the Saints will try to do what they did last week against Philadelphia and establish the run early on in the game.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Ingram, who didn't play a ton throughout the season, kind of started to emerge, especially with Pierre Thomas being out last week, and had probably the best game of his entire career against Philadelphia in the playoffs. In the previous game against the Seahawks, he had just 8 carries for 22 yards. Really wasn't effective at all in that game.
No, I mean, 3 of those were on the final possession of the game when they were basically running out the clock. So he only had 5 meaningful carries. And, you know, his usage has been up and down, but he also had 13 carries for 83 yards in week 15 at Carolina before 18 for 97 last week at Philadelphia. And it seems like one philosophy is that they're trying to really do that on the road where they've struggled so much to try to keep in the game and not fall behind like they did in Seattle.
And also chews up, some of the clock. I wonder if with Ingram playing well and with Thomas out, I have no idea where I'm going with this. I had a thought and it completely disappeared.
It's unclear whether Thomas will be back this week.
I think that they would probably stick with Ingram there, though. He's been their workhorse back lately. And, oh, against, this is what I was thinking. Against the Eagles last week, when they were basically playing out the final drive, they seemed unstoppable in the run. It seemed like the Eagles could not stop Mark Ingram, and they're not a bad defensive team against the run.
And he's averaged nearly 5 yards a carry this season, so he's been effective much of the year, and that gives him a different dimension when they're running the football.
It was really that won them the game. If the Seahawks have been so good against the run lately that I would be really surprised if Mark Ingram had a big game against them, but he's got the best chance of anybody. He's got the best chance of anybody to really chew up a lot of yards on each carry, and I think that's something that Seahawks have to be really scared of.
Yeah, and I think the Saints will definitely try to do it, especially to keep Breeze out of the third and long situations. They don't want to have those early in the game.
Yeah, and when they look for Jimmy Graham, they want it to be 3rd and 3, 3rd and 4, 3rd and 5, so that these checkdowns can pick up first downs and they can keep the chains moving.
Yeah, they only had two sustained drives in the last game.
Darren Sproles in the last game wasn't particularly effective, and the Seahawks, we talked about this actually before the New Orleans game, are really good at stopping running backs coming out of the backfield receiving.
And have even been better over the course of the season, I feel like. You know, there was a couple of games, the Houston game stands out, where that was kind of an issue, backs coming out of the backfield and tight ends. But after about the midpoint of the season, that has not been a problem whatsoever.
Yeah, it's been a long time since we've had to be concerned about it. And Sproles in that game really was not a threat at all and wasn't anything that they were concerned with. And again, credit has to go to the linebackers there. I mean, those linebackers picking up Sproles, finding him on all those plays, and bringing him down is really impressive.
That's a tough matchup, but that's where the athleticism and size that Pete Carroll likes to look for in his linebackers has really paid off. And Bruce Irvin's a guy we haven't mentioned his name yet, but he was very effective in that game in coverage.
Yeah, I was thinking that Bruce Irvin, especially playing against Jimmy Graham, you would assume that maybe just his general coverage ability isn't quite up to par with defending somebody of the caliber of Jimmy Graham, since this is his first year playing linebacker. But he obviously has the speed and obviously has the size to play with Jimmy Graham, and it seems like he's really getting a feel for the position.
Yeah, he's taken it to it quite quickly, and again, with KJ Wright being out of the lineup, he takes on a little additional importance.
Right now, the defense is playing out of their minds. The best we've ever seen the Seahawks defense play. And this is a bit of an aside, but I really think Dan Quinn's going to get a job out of this.
It kind of sounds like he might get the Tennessee job at this point.
Gus Bradley last year managed to get a job out of the Seahawks defense, and they faded pretty severely at the end of the season. They got to a point at the end of the season where it really felt like the offense was carrying the defense.
I mean, the difference is Gus Bradley had more experience in that role, whereas this is Quinn's first year as a defensive coordinator at the NFL level.
I mean, it'll be really impressive if Dan Quinn could be a defensive coordinator for one season and get a head coaching job out of it.
It's the new England as far as turning position coordinators into head coaches elsewhere.
But this has been such an impressive job with bringing players basically completely out of nowhere. We're talking about how great Byron Maxwell is. He looks like such a natural replacement for Brandon Browner. We're not even talking about Brandon Browner anymore.
Yep.
And they're just bringing these guys up. It's like next man up. And they're doing equally as good or better than the player before them. And seeing the defense peak at this point in the season is really exciting, especially playing against an offensive team.
Although it helps when you're able to fit those guys into a secondary that already includes two defensive player of the year candidates. Yeah. That takes some of the pressure off of you.
So what did you see when you looked at the Saints' wide receivers? At Marcus Colston, Kenny Stills, and players like that?
You know, not a lot of differentiation between them in that game. They didn't necessarily go to the spread as much as I expected. A lot of heavy personnel, and sometimes they even looked to use that to set up the pass.
And it looked like they kind of got nothing going. I mean, they hit, as far as wide receivers go, Marcus Colston for 4 catches, Lance Moore for 2, Robert Meacham for 1, and Kenny Stills for 1. And Kenny Stills, who I thought going into that game would be a really big X factor going downfield. I thought he was somebody who might be able to get loose a little bit in the Seahawks secondary. Had 1 catch for 3 yards.
I mean, that's kind of what Kenny Stills is, though. He's a boom or bust player. Like, you know, he might have that 60-yard touchdown catch that totally changes the game, or he might be a complete non-factor.
So in that game, I thought it was kind of strange. So this was Maxwell's first game starting, as I mentioned, with Walter Thurman being suspended. Judging by side that they threw to, Richard Sherman typically plays on the right side, Byron Maxwell typically plays on the left side, or Browner, whomever. They threw 10 times to Maxwell's side and 20 times to Richard Sherman's side in that game.
It's a little tough to make sense of those numbers because they were, as we've talked about, they were checking down so much that it may not have mattered. They may also have been targeting linebackers as opposed to cornerbacks at that point, but yeah, it wasn't necessarily, they weren't looking Maxwell's direction.
Going into that game, I really assumed that they would. And then the following week, playing against Jim Harbaugh, and Harbaugh you would assume is going to be really good at finding these mismatches, threw 22 times to Maxwell's side and just 6 times to Richard Sherman's side.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that's something they've picked up on tape, and that's one of the changes that we might see from the last matchup.
I mean, I would expect them to at least target it equally. It was kind of surprising. I mean, even after going to that game, you thought to yourself, why didn't they throw at him a little bit more here? I mean, it was his first game as a starter.
So the other difference personnel-wise, we've talked about KJ Wright, but the Seahawks did not have Walter Thurman in that game, and now he's back in the lineup after serving his 4-game suspension. He and Jeremy Lain pretty much equally split the snaps as the nickel corner in Week 17 against St. Louis, and it'll be interesting to see if that arrangement continues.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, honestly, I don't know if I can tell really much of a difference between them. I think they're both really good.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
It's basically the Seahawks have the secondary that goes, the two safeties are great. Beyond that, you don't really know because they've never seen the field, really. And then you've got 3 corners who are interchangeably great. Or 4 corners, I guess, and Browner, if you include him. They basically go 5 corners deep with excellent cornerbacks.
Which is pretty incredible, depth to have at that position.
But what it does mean is that both Lane and Thurman, and they'll probably come in from Maxwell at various different points, are all going to be able to be really rested. If there's one long drive that one of them is playing, the other one can come in for the next drive, and they're going to remain really fresh throughout the game.
It'll be interesting to see if the Seahawks consider using any dime personnel at all. That's not something they usually like to do. They usually only like to bring in that extra nickel back. But, you know, potentially if there's a Saints spread, you could go to...
No, and I would be surprised, too, since they throw so much coming out of the backfield and have a big tight end. I would be surprised if they took any more of the linebackers off the field, if they didn't have at least 2 linebackers on the field for most of the game. And that's what they were really successful in with all of these checkdowns, is they're making these tackles immediately.
Yeah.
And so you would assume that you would want bigger personnel on.
Well, should we flip to the other side of the football when the Seahawks have the ball?
So I want to say this. There's been a lot of talk about the Seahawks offense not moving very well lately. They've had kind of fits and starts. And I think that it's more than just that. I mean, I know that the tendency is when you're the home crowd to put everything on your team and nothing on the opponents. But looking at those weighted DVOAs, so the Seahawks are number 1 in defensive DVOA. Right, and I was like, who is number 2? I thought it would be Arizona. Turns out number 2 is actually the New York Giants. So their last 4 opponents have been San Francisco is number 11, New York Giants who are number 2, Arizona who are number 3, and St. Louis who are number 6. So they've been playing 4 of the best defenses in the NFL these last 4 weeks, and I think it's made it seem like the defense hasn't been playing, or like the offense hasn't been playing particularly well, when rather they're just playing against really good defenses.
To me, the other factor I'm looking at is third down conversion rates. So against Arizona and against the Giants and then the first half of the St. Louis game, the Seahawks really struggled to pick up third downs. And, you know, if you look at the history of Football Outsiders research, what they've found is that third down conversion rates tend to be something that regress to the mean. You're not going to generally play that much different on third down than you're going to play on first down and second down. And it's got an outsized importance because that means that's the difference between a 3-and-out and an extended drive and staying on the field. So it's actually kind of something of, you know, it's not the worst thing if you've played poorly on third down in the past, because it means you're probably going to play better in the future. And
if it's in the past, you want it to stay there.
Yeah, it's not a good thing at the time. If you look at the Seahawks third down conversion rates week to week, there's not really a lot of correlation. You know, they go in 1 week, they converted 75% at Arizona, followed by 20% at St. Louis. And that had a big impact on both of those games and how they went. But it's not like there was a different team, really, from 1 week to the next. It's a little bit fluky. There's a lot of noise involved in that. So, I mean, on the one
hand... a lot of it's luck, and we try to explain it in different ways,
yes.
Right? So the offensive line was almost exactly the same between Arizona and St. Louis. But in St. Louis, we explained it as the offensive line was the problem. And against Arizona, we didn't necessarily explain it as the offensive line wasn't the problem.
I mean, humans are very good at constructing explanations for what actually is no more
than noise. And
you'll
post this chart on the page.
I will. And so there's a concern here, because it's true, if you have a rough day converting third downs, and the Seahawks have had their share of those this season. They converted 1 out of 8 third downs passing the football at Indianapolis, taking out run plays. So they've had those kind of games.
Sounds like there was a little bit of luck involved.
I'm not going to laugh for that. You're not going to get a laugh out of that.
Nothing.
That's kind of the recipe for if you're looking for how an upset might happen in the playoffs.
I still think that's funny. Anyway.
Yeah, you can't amuse everyone, so you might as well amuse yourself. if the Seahawks have a rough day converting third downs, that could be the recipe for an upset in the playoffs. But at the same time, the fact that they were so poor on third down in the last 3 weeks of the season really doesn't mean that much going forward. It's more about the overall average.
No, and I mean, it also does mean that they're playing against really good teams, though, you know? And the Saints are really good defense. I wonder, so the Saints throughout the season, it's kind of strange because in that Seahawks game, in December, and this is probably a little bit of what Pete Carroll's talking about, is you have to throw everything out that already happened. The Saints generally have been a pretty good team against the run and a really bad team against the pass. And in that game, a really good team against the pass and a really bad team against the run. And in that game, Russell Wilson passed the ball really well, and Marshawn Lynch didn't run the ball all that effectively.
Yeah, it was one of Russell's better games of the season in terms of his execution, and it made up for the fact that it wasn't a big game on the ground.
And it was antithetical to what the Saints have done throughout the season. I think that the Saints realized that the Seahawks are a team who like to run the ball, and they were really particular about trying to defend that.
Yeah, and I think the Seahawks came out with a game plan to take advantage of that. It was something we talked about, them not them looking to establish the run, but instead they basically used some game theory and tried to counter that and used a lot of play action to set up, for example, the big long pass to Zach Miller early in that game.
I wonder if things will flip around this time. So you mentioned in your notes that the Saints rushed five or more defenders only three times during that game, and that they're basically trying to stay home and meet those holes and bring down Marshawn Lynch, right?
Well, it's an interesting thing because Rob Ryan has a reputation as a guy who uses a lot of blitzes, but at the same time, he's also someone who tends to only bring three or maybe four and sit back and play coverage more than almost any other defensive coordinator. So he very rarely uses the traditional five-man blitz. And so, yeah, there was only three of those big blitzes of six or more rushers in that game. And one of the biggest plays of the game to me was second quarter coming out of a timeout, third and eight. It's pretty clear that the Saints are going to bring pressure. They walk up a bunch of their linebackers and nickel defenders to the line, and they eventually bring eight guys. The Seahawks are able to pick it up just enough, single coverage on the edge, and Wilson hangs in there and throws a gorgeous deep ball to Doug Baldwin for a 52-yard pickup. To me, the most important play of that entire game.
Yeah, I wonder if that will continue through this game, if there's that obvious blitz situation. Obviously, the Seahawks knew that that was coming before it was coming, right?
Yeah, it was pretty evident. I mean, even like watching the game, you could feel this is a big blitz situation.
It was one of those situations where you know it's coming and you just have to defend against it. The Seahawks had a good enough offense that they should be able to take advantage of that. And I wonder if that's one of the areas where Percy Harvin potentially coming back will help them out.
He gives them another threat. It's something else that they have to worry about. Now, one of the situations that they picked up when the Saints brought just three and sat back in coverage was a little screen pass to Golden Tate at the line of scrimmage where he broke a bunch of tackles and picked up a third and long situation. And that's kind of play where Percy Harvin could be another playmaker if he's able to go.
Yeah, I think both of those situations would be really good. If they're dropping back, Percy will have the chance to maybe get a little bit of room before he's able to go. And Golden, honestly, on either side, having those players, this is what we've been waiting for all season, is having the option of these two players who can't be tackled on either side or even together on the same side, because Golden Tate's a good blocker also, with Jermaine Kearse out there potentially as another really good blocker. But Percy in one-on-one coverage against a big blitz could be somebody, if he breaks one tackle, he's running for a long way.
Now, the other risk of the big blitz against the Seahawks is if Russell Wilson can elude it, then he's suddenly got room down the field. And that's one thing that happened when they brought seven men. He miraculously managed to get out of it, picked up 13 yards. It did come back on a Russell Okung hands-to-the-face penalty, but in, you know, amazing performance by Russell to do that. And I think that's one of the reasons they may drop back into coverage, is worrying about him scrambling.
And do you think that, so the Saints are without their first-round draft pick, Kenny Vaccaro, who had a really good season in some discussion for a Defensive Rookie of the Year this season, probably won't win it, but in the conversation. And do you think that him being on IR will affect things?
It should, in theory. He was a big part of what they were doing, you know, using him in kind of a similar manner to Earl Thomas, who was his predecessor at Texas and is kind of a center fielder. And that allowed them to play three safeties a lot. They played Roman Harper is kind of a nickel back in more of a linebacker role. Now he's having to do more traditional safety things, and he is not so good at those.
Which he clearly doesn't feel comfortable playing. I love Kenny Vaccaro. He was one of my favorite players in the draft coming out this year. I remember watching him during the pre-draft workouts during the combine, and I thought he was really good. It was really exciting combine action. It's like, that Vaccaro guy is going to be really good.
That was not a joke. He meant that
too. No, I watched that. I watched it a lot because they replay it over and over and over again on the NFL Network. But he had a really good season, and he's somebody who, again, I think Earl Thomas is an obvious comparison, but he's like another cornerback out there.
Yeah, and that's how they used him oftentimes, is a nickelback. But the surprising thing is that they have not actually played that much worse after Vaccaro went down defensively. I mean, they came up with a pretty solid performance against the Eagles last week.
They did. They gave up a lot of big plays against the Eagles, though, especially in the second half.
Yeah, well, what happened there was
with Keenan Lewis going out.
Suffering a concussion during the second half of that game, and suddenly that weakened their cornerbacks considerably. So he has indicated that he definitely plans to play this week, and that seems to be likely.
But I do think in this situation, especially with Kenny Vaccaro being out, the numbers kind of lie a little bit. I think that the Saints' secondary is considerably worse than it looks like statistically. I mean, they've had some excellent games, but I think that since he's gone down, it hasn't really mattered because they played one easy game against Tampa Bay, and they showed a lot of weakness against the Eagles. On big plays last week, especially in the second half, and that's more than just Keenan Lewis being out.
But it took some time for the Eagles to get going, and you know, given what Philadelphia's offense has done this season, I think it was a pretty impressive performance overall. The other player they lost is Paris Harrelson, one of their starting outside linebackers, who played about half the defensive snaps in the Monday Night Football game. He was basically trading off with Roman Harper.
Yes, it'll be interesting. I mean, the Saints' defense is obviously weak, and if anybody goes down in this game, they're going to be down pretty deep. The Seahawks at this point are only missing K.J. Wright.
Yeah, and then offensively, the question mark besides Harvin is Luke Wilson, whether he's able to come back from that high ankle sprain.
And it seems to be that Luke Wilson is coming back. The Seahawks haven't brought anybody in to replace him, have they?
Yeah, it sounds very positive, all the indications from practice so far. We'll see by the end of the week. But he was, you know, a factor in the game plan in a variety of different roles in that Monday Night Football
game. Both of the tight ends were.
Yeah, a lot of Zach Miller split out wide in that game.
Yeah, they must have seen something, and it obviously worked. He had a 60-yard catch followed by a touchdown catch right after that.
Yeah.
So I think that they've seen something there. I mean, the Saints are not particularly bad against any receiver. I mean, they're pretty effective against all of them, but I think that in particular the Seahawks like to work Miller, and they'll probably work Miller and Wilson in the game plan this week.
The other thing we saw in that game was a lot of running backs split wide out of the backfield to try to exploit some personnel tendencies, and Michael Robinson in that role ended up with a big catch along the sidelines. It'll be interesting to see if they continue doing that.
I would probably expect that to happen. I think it'll be interesting to see that maybe might run out of a set like that. If they move somebody like Robinson outside, bring the defenders outside, and then hand the ball off to Marshawn Lynch there.
Or one of the interesting scenarios is you split Marshawn Lynch wide and put Percy Harvin in the backfield if he's healthy.
That'd be really interesting. And also Russell Wilson running. I think that they're going to do a lot of running with backs spread wide.
Do you anticipate more read option in the playoffs because you're not as concerned with injuring Russell Wilson, that sort of thing?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that they're a team who wants to run the read option. They run it when they have to, but I think that the offense will stay pretty similar. I would expect that in any way that the offense is going to change, I think it'll change because of the addition of Percy Harvin.
See, I tend to disagree. I think we may see some more read option. It's something that the Saints, I don't think, have been very effective at defending this season. That was some of the talk going into the Philadelphia game. The Seahawks did run it. I charted 5 times in the Monday Night Football game. It's a little difficult to tell sometimes whether it's a true read option or if it's just a look like that where Marshawn Lynch is going to get the ball either way. But Russell Wilson found some lanes at times, picked up a first down, and then also picked up 2 first downs, I think.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't played too many teams who would potentially run it. They played against the 49ers and defended against it pretty well. They defended everything well against the 49ers. And then they played against the Panthers twice and really didn't give up too much on the ground there. I mean, they've done a pretty effective job against that. It'll be curious to see. I don't think that the Seahawks aren't running read option because they're concerned about Russell getting hurt, though.
I think that's a factor. I mean, obviously, he's very good at managing
also,
to avoid
also, they're probably more concerned about Russell getting hurt right now than they were during the regular season.
I feel like now is when you have to pull all the stops.
We're not there yet.
What do you expect from Marshawn Lynch in this game?
I think Marshawn Lynch is going to have a huge game. I think that the trends that we've seen with the Saints throughout the season and the ways that they didn't present themselves in the last game, I think that they're going to present themselves in this game. I think the Seahawks in particular are really concerned with establishing Marshawn Lynch. Part of their problems were that they were playing against really good defenses and really good run defenses in particular, like the Giants and the Cardinals and the Rams. But they're going to establish the run here. The Seahawks are going to run the ball really well in this game.
I mean, I think whenever Pete Carroll has either a poor game or a lot of time off between games, that's when they start to think about establishing the run.
Because
any situation where
when he's away from the run for too long, he starts longing for the run.
Do you expect to see things opened up? One of the theories I had about why the Seahawks were struggling on third down late in the season was that they were saving some of their more exotic play calls for the playoffs.
Now,
we saw a few more
that.
Of those in the second half of the St. Louis game, I feel like.
I was listening to a radio broadcast of the flea flicker that they ran, and I think that this might be the time. They might save it depending on how things go in this game, but this might be the time that they open up the playbook a little bit more. They had 2 weeks to put stuff in there, too.
That's something I'd look for. You know, obviously, Daryl Bevel had a couple of job interviews last week, as we talked about.
I doubt that's affecting them opening
this
up
this week,
offense.
They've got a full week of solid practice here to put some new stuff in and potentially a new weapon in Percy Harvin.
But if I have to go in a Nostra Tristan mode...
if you have
put
to.
Put on my Nostra Tristan hat. I'm not actually wearing a hat. But I mimicked putting on a Nostra Tristan hat, because Nostradamus apparently wore a hat. I think that it's going to be a really close game. I don't think it's going to be a blowout like it was last game. I mean, I would say that with pretty much any playoff game. But I think that this is going to be a really close game. I think that the defense is going to show some chinks in the armor. I think that the defense is not going to play to the level that they have the last 4 weeks, and probably not as good as they played against the Saints, when they basically stopped one of the best offenses in the league and held them to nothing at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can count on that. It was the worst New Orleans offensive performance in how long?
It's been years. I think that they're going to give up more, and it's going to be scary. Right?
No matter what, it's going to be scary.
Everything is going to be scary.
I'm scared right now.
But I think that what it's going to come down to is I think the offense will move really well. I actually predict a high-scoring game, which is a little bit strange. When you look at the fateful four, what you think of is these low-scoring games between them or the Seahawks dominating the 49ers. But what you think of is these low-scoring defensive battles, right? And I think that this is actually going to be kind of a high-scoring game. I think that the Seahawks offense moves the ball really well. And I think that the thing that it'll come down to will be when Drew Brees makes mistakes, which he's going to make at some point one or two mistakes, he'll either get hit and fumble or he'll throw a pick, is how does the defense capitalize on those mistakes? Do they return it for a touchdown like they did against the Rams or like they did against the Saints early in the year? Or is it something where the offense is put on the field and has to drive 60 yards?
See, I tend to see it as a more defensive game than you do. I think that's kind of the nature of the playoffs. When you have this much time to scout an opponent and focus in, I think that tends to produce, obviously it didn't work in the Indianapolis, Kansas City.
Yeah, defensive game.
A variety of reasons. But the other games this week, I think, were generally lower scoring than expected. I mean, Philadelphia and New Orleans, I think you thought going in, that's going to be a shootout.
But it turned into a shootout in the second half.
I mean, still, the final score didn't necessarily reflect
maybe not
that.
A shootout, but it might be one of those games where it's a little bit close going to the half, and then the offense really opens up in the second half.
Now, do you feel like it's a game three of the four games last weekend were decided on the final possession, and two of the four were decided by which team had the ball last. Do you feel like it's going to be that competitive?
I do.
Wow.
You're asking that like we've already talked about this before. You're like setting it up. That was me cracking the ball out of the park.
I mean, I was honestly curious to know. I don't think so.
Here's a prediction. No, Sir Tristan again. I think it'll come down to the Seahawks are up by more than 3 points. 4, 5, 6, potentially 7.
God willing.
The Saints are driving down the field, and they have one play from inside the red zone to either score a touchdown or the game is over.
So like the St. Louis game then?
I think it'll be really similar to many of the games that the Seahawks have played. The St. Louis game, the Detroit game, and I think it'll come down to something like that.
I do not think this game will be decided on the final possession.
Really?
I don't think that it'll be a lopsided game by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it will
be. I really hope that it's not, because even thinking about that makes me nervous.
And if I was to do a Nostra Kevin, which I can't do because it has never been correct, as Nostra Tristan has, I would say that I think a special teams play is going to swing this game.
I would not be surprised by that. I think special teams would be really important. And it's one place, like we talked about, where the Saints are not up to par with the rest of the fateful four teams.
But the Seahawks and their losses have had just weird, bad special teams play.
They have. I think that's a place where Percy Harvin could really make an impact. Because as Pete Carroll said, if he's going, he's going. There's no Percy Harvin playing a little bit. There's no easing Percy Harvin into the offense. He's either playing or he's not. This is the playoffs.
And that would be good, because there was a lot of things I liked about rewatching that New Orleans game, but watching Robert Turbin turn kicks was not one of them.
It makes you sad.
It did. It was like, oh no.
I think Doug Baldwin's a really good kick returner. I don't ever want to see Robert Turbin return another kick ever again.
And Jermaine Kearse is potentially available in that role if Harvin doesn't play it.
But assuming, and it looks like Percy Harvin's going to play, assuming that Percy Harvin plays and return kicks, I could really see him making a big play in special teams. But I think that big play might put the team ahead in the third or fourth quarter. Might put the Seahawks ahead in the third or fourth quarter. It could be very similar to the national championship game, which was played a couple of nights ago.
Oh, that sounds horrifying.
Yeah.
I was so glad that I had nothing invested in that game. It was a great game to watch.
It was a horrifying game. So we have to talk about, before we do percentage chance to win, how scared are you?
Oh, so scared.
I'm terrified.
I mean, you can't look at the history of the NFL playoffs over the last 6 years and not be terrified.
That was Bill Simmons' column last week talking about how basically the playoffs never go chalk anymore. The top teams never make it to the Super Bowl anymore. It's like, please no. Please stop.
It was like a note directed to Seahawks fans. Like,
he actually had a note directed to Seahawks fans.
He did. Calm the F down. You're not in the Super Bowl, the SB word, yet.
Yeah, we don't say that, yeah. Those words around here. The game which concludes the NFL season.
I mean, there's a happy medium here. I think that there are some people who are panicked.
I'm, like, stressed right now.
I think there's some people who are panicked because of the way the Seahawks ended the season offensively. And I don't feel like that. I feel like the Seahawks, they are the best team in the NFL. I mean, DVOA is pretty clear about it. But there are no guarantees in a single game format of being the best team in the league.
Yeah, I mean, I it could very easily come down to one random play that we could not predict at all. It could come down to, the Seahawks could blow out the Saints. The options, I don't think, are that the Saints blow out the Seahawks. I think the options are that the Seahawks blow out the Saints, or they play a super close game. We just talked for 40 minutes about this game. That's how big of a deal this is.
And it didn't even feel like 40 minutes.
No, it felt. This is the first time that I've actually talked about this game. I've gone out of my way to really not pay attention to this game. I listened to the Pete Carroll interview on Monday, but I am so nervous about it.
I mean, to me, the other thing that this means is if the Seahawks do lose, either next week or sometime in the future, there's going to be a narrative that develops that they lost because the offense isn't good enough, because of the wide receivers.
Well, there's an obvious excuse there with Percy Harvin coming back.
It's not even an excuse. It's just that this is the weakness that caused them to lose. But it may not be a weakness. It may just be in one given week any of these Fateful Four teams can beat any of the others.
Yes. I like that you're using the Fateful Four now. It's catching on.
Yeah, you've doubled the number of people using it in the last 40 minutes.
All right. We're both concerned. Everybody's concerned. I'm so
Some
scared.
People are not concerned, and that concerns me that they're not concerned.
I agree. You know, the one thing I keep imagining myself on Sunday, I'm just hoping that the Seahawks will have won. How great will it be to watch a game that you don't have to be panicked about?
Like, great would it be?
Okay, yes. Dear God. I can't believe this. I'm knocking on wood. I don't even know why, but I'm knocking on wood. I'm very scared.
As well you should be. So on that note, chances of winning?
65%.
I think I said 65 last time, because that's basically even teams with home field. And I feel now that the Seahawks are the better team, so I'm going to say 70.
I'm lowering it a little bit because of how frightening the playoffs are and how random the playoffs are.
That's fair.
And I want to, and this is another question, I know we have to stop talking about the Seahawks, but do you think that there's a rivalry developing between the Seahawks and the Saints?
I don't know. It's tough. I think there's too much respect for between the two teams for there really to be a rivalry. I mean, there wasn't any bitterness or anything in that last game.
The Saints are a pretty unhateable team.
Drew Brees and Sean Payton have been very, you know, respectful in their comments in the last.
They
few
really
days.
Have. They're the anti-49ers.
Yeah. So it's hard for that. I mean, the other, you know, maybe if there was a contentious result on Saturday, it could become a rivalry, but not now.
Yeah, I think it's also been too one-sided. The Seahawks have won. They won a big game in the playoffs, and then they also dominated this last time that they played.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about that.
I don't remember either of those games. We have amnesia. Changnesia, which we'll come back to.
We should talk really quickly about Husky basketball.
Yeah, so I have something to admit before we talk about Husky basketball. And I don't like to admit this in a lot of situations, but I am an open Husky basketball bandwagon jumper.
Wow. So, who knew? I mean, it's one thing when mom jumps on the Seahawks bandwagon, but when you start jumping on bandwagons...
I mean, I'm always a fan of the Husky basketball team, but the amount that I pay attention to the Husky basketball team directly correlates with how good they are.
That is one of the worst traits you can possibly have.
I think it's probably because I am not... This is not bandwagon. I hate college basketball.
That's true. You hate college basketball even when the Huskies are playing well.
I hate everything about college basketball. I hate watching college basketball. I hate thinking about college basketball. I like the NCAA tournament, and I like the way that they choose teams for college basketball. And I like the amount of teams that make the postseason. Those are some positives.
Well,
some negatives are everything else. I hate the shot clock. I hate 20-minute halves. I hate refereeing. I hate five fouls to foul out. I hate that.
Howlins? You gotta put Howlins.
Oh, I hate Howlins. I hate that. Yeah, if you call a timeout, it doesn't negate the TV timeout that's coming. Come on! I do like Gus Johnson. There's another like. But I think that that's the problem. The Huskies have to be really good and really interesting for me to pay attention.
To overcome everything else.
But I'm interested in Husky basketball right now.
That is a stunning turnaround in the last week.
Yeah, when they played Arizona State last week, I didn't even know that game was happening. I saw a tweet from you hours later, and it's like, oh, the Huskies won, cool. I thought it was at home. I was like, oh, that's why Al's not returning my calls. Turns out you weren't returning my calls for some other reason.
I didn't want to talk to you.
Yeah.
I already talked to you enough on the podcast. I don't need to talk to you offline. Yeah, it was a really good weekend for the Huskies in the desert. They went 1-1, but came up with a blowout win at Arizona State, which was completely stunning given how terrible they had been through much of the non-conference schedule, and then led much of the way at Arizona on Saturday before eventually succumbing to lack of depth and foul trouble and Arizona being really tall and really good.
What do you think was the difference between the Huskies here and some of their non-conference games?
Oh, they played defense. I mean, offensively, they executed better as well, but mostly, I mean, the offense was really good in the non-conference schedule, as I broke down last week on the blog, but they could not stop anyone whatsoever, and it was a complete 180 in Arizona last week, so I really don't have any idea how to process that analytically.
I mean, Lawrence Romer is a good Pac-12 coach and conference coach, I suppose we should say, but I still thought that the defense got insanely lost sometimes. It was kind of shocking to watch them, and I didn't watch almost any of the non-conference games, so I can't really speak to how bad they were then. But seeing players who were so confused defensively was really shocking to me from a Lorenzo Romar team.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that held over, was the situations where players did, in fact, get completely lost. But on most plays when they weren't lost, they were contesting shots.
I thought the defense played well, despite the plays.
Yeah, which was not, again, something that we saw in non-conference. So I don't know. I mean, last year they started out, I believe, 4-0 in non-conference play. One at Stanford and Cal.
In conference play.
Yeah, and that was pretty much the high point of the entire season by far, and they struggled thereafter.
What is going on outside your house?
It's a cat freaky out somewhere.
Okay, we just paused to go look for a cat fight, which is something that happens when you're in Boulevard Park.
Yeah, there's a lot of stray cats around here.
A lot of stray cats. They've taken over many of the houses. The house that burned down the street and nobody ever did anything with it. Cat house now.
The house that our cousin didn't buy. Yeah. 2000, yeah.
You can't kick the cats out. So the Husky basketball team.
This week we'll find out a little bit more about whether that improvement in Arizona was for real. They get Utah tomorrow night and then Colorado on Sunday. And that's suddenly a pretty difficult pair of teams.
I'm excited for those games. Like, I'm going to watch them. I know that they're happening.
Well, you're going to watch Sunday even though it's on against the NFL playoffs?
Okay, probably not.
Okay.
We'll watch in tandem. We'll have two TVs on, one with the NFL playoffs, one with Husky basketball.
Utah has DeLon Wright, the brother of Darrell Wright of the Blazers, a JC transfer who's immediately become one of the best players in the Pac-12 conference, rather unexpectedly. So they're much improved from the last couple of years. And then Colorado is pretty much a perennial top 25 team at this point.
That's going a little bit too far. Perennial top 25 team?
All right, perennial NCAA tournament team.
How many years have they gone to the NCAA tournament in a row? Perennial means 10 years in a row.
Every single year they've been in the Pac-12, they've gone to the NCAA tournament.
That's 2 years?
Yes.
Colorado is not a perennial. Repeat, Colorado is not a perennial NCAA tournament team.
But they're a good team this year. They beat Oregon at home, ended their undefeated start to the season on Sunday. So they're going to be very tough to beat.
Yeah, these games are going to be a real cat fight. It was a cat fight down in the desert against Arizona. But I'm looking forward to it. I thought Paris Blackwell was really solid in the post. Sean Kemp didn't really play that much in the Arizona game that I watched.
Had foul trouble, but it was his best game of the season.
But it was also kind of shocking seeing how bad defensively Nigel Williams-Goss is.
Yeah, that's his liability. You know, and he struggled.
Are we going to start calling him NWG at any point?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he made some freshman mistakes down the stretch of that Arizona game, which stood out only because he normally doesn't make those. One interesting stat, there's only one top 100 freshman in the country that's playing more minutes than Nigel Williams-Goss, and that's Syracuse point guard Tyler Ennis.
Oh, really? Not Jabari Parker?
No.
Wow.
I think he's playing about the same as Parker and a couple other guys.
I'm surprised that it's not one of those big players.
But that's stunning to ask that much of your freshman point guard.
No, I thought he's a really good offensive player. They were talking on the broadcast about how he might have the best floater in the entire Pac-12. But his defense was really shockingly bad. But it's something that if you're going to come to UW with Lorenzo Romar, know that you'll be here for a couple of years, he's going to fix that at some point.
I don't know. I mean, to some extent, if it's a matter of foot speed, you may not be able to fix it, but he'll definitely improve.
So I'm interested in the game. The other question that I had, so there was the time period where, and you were talking about this, the freshman mistakes, where the offense got totally out of control against Arizona. It was kind of a shocking time period because you didn't really understand what was going on. Why was this team who'd played fairly composed through most of the game all of a sudden driving to the basket, knowing that the refs wouldn't call fouls in these plays, and throwing up crazy shots?
And they played slow-paced much of the game. They really tried to control tempo and shorten the game as much as possible against Arizona. So that was a surprise to me. I don't know that I have a good explanation for what happened there.
I mean, freshman mistakes is the explanation.
But it wasn't just Nigel Williams-Goss. It was a team-wide thing to really try to push the ball and attack. And
I would like to hope that it wasn't Romar suggesting that they do this, because it was obviously a terrible strategy.
I don't know. Is it better? Is it worse if they were just doing this on their own and not listening to Romar?
I'm going to say that that's better, because then you could chalk it up to freshman mistakes instead of process mistakes or coaching mistakes.
I see.
The other thing is that not having a one player who you can go to for a basket, and most college teams don't really have this. You don't. Not every team has Isaiah Thomas or has Brandon Roy.
I mean, I think C.J. Wilcox is pretty close to that. I mean,
C.J. Wilcox
is one of the leading scorers in the Pac-12.
Is a really good scorer in the pull-up game. He's not a good scorer at making his own shot.
Yeah, he's improved in that regard, but he's still not that good.
His handling is not good. He's not good at driving. When he shoots after dribbling and then shooting, he's not very good.
I mean, to me, again, the bigger issue is, you know, you don't have anyone defensively that when another team has a player like that, you don't have an answer for it necessarily.
You don't think there's one person who can shut down that other team's best player?
No, I mean, Wilcox has played some pretty good defense against smaller guys, and Andrew Andrews is a pit bull defensively, but and Mike Anderson has done a nice job, but again, there's no one stopper.
Watching this game really made me nostalgic for kind of what I would call the glory years of Husky basketball. In that period, I was like, where's Vinoy Overton? Despite everything about Vinoy Overton, I really wanted him out there. Right?
I was okay now that we put him in.
I was so excited. Because, I mean, I'm not going to say, where's Isaiah Thomas? Because those players only come around once every 10 years or so. You're not going to have, like, a superstar caliber player who's a really good NBA player on your team at all times, unless you're one of the elite programs. But having somebody like Vinoy Overton, an energy guy who's a really good defender, who can make things happen out there, is really what I think they need.
You know what the weird thing is? We're talking about these guys that are Seattle products. You know how many Washington State players there are on the UW basketball roster now? Scholarship players.
One.
Zero.
That's crazy.
Hakeem Stewart transferred. He was the only one.
Really? Where'd he go?
I haven't heard anywhere yet.
They didn't want him on the team.
Hopefully somewhere.
Hopefully he landed next
year. So they'll have one next year. They've got a player coming in from Timberline in Olympia, but Donovan Dorsey, but
there won't be anyone
from the Puget Sound area.
Players from Seattle are just going elsewhere. Are they too good?
I mean, a lot of guys have wanted to go to the Big East, have kind of preferred the exposure there, and the Louisville pipeline is pretty strong. They got the number one prospect in the 2014 class, Shaquan Aaron. Yeah, it's just one of those weird things, but it looks like it'll probably change in 2015. The Huskies just offered two guys from Rainier Beach, which is just dominating, won the Les Schwab tournament down in Portland, very prestigious, against the number one prospect in the 2014 class, Jahlil Okafor.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. Any relation?
Yes.
Present. Really? All right. It's unfortunate that the class that came through, though, you know, the Brandon Roy class, the Isaiah Thomas class, the Nate Robinson class, that didn't translate to all of the players from Seattle coming to UW, because if they would have, this would be an elite program right now.
Yeah, it'd be a little different. I mean, the talent went down a little bit, and then sometimes it's just a choice. Like, you know, I think that you have probably recruited Nigel Williams-Goss more than they recruited Zach LaVine, knowing that Williams-Goss is likely to stay around longer and was a true point guard, whereas LaVine is more of a scorer. And, some of those things. And then, you know, someone like Gaddy just didn't live up to the expectations and the hype coming into college.
Yeah, but I wonder, I feel like Peyton Siva is really where it started, though.
But then there's some guys that just need to get away.
Terrence Williams was before Peyton Siva?
He was the first guy that went to Patino and started that pipeline. But Peyton Siva just needed to get away because of his family situation. So, you know, every player is unique. It's a little tough to... That's the weird thing about basketball recruiting. It's not football recruiting where you've got 25 guys. It's contingent on, like, one or two prospects every year.
That's interesting that they don't have anybody from Washington, though. And it's still a good area right now in the Seattle area.
It's very odd because last year was the first time they hadn't had an NBA player from Washington on the roster, let alone no one, period.
Huh. That's interesting. Do you want any chances of victory in these games?
I would say 45% against Utah and 35% against Colorado.
I don't know if I feel confident enough, having watched one Husky basketball game, basically.
And knowing nothing about Colorado to Utah besides what I just told you.
I don't know if I feel confident enough. I'll say I think they'll win one of the games.
Okay.
I would be really excited if they did, too.
Yeah, it'll be a solid result if they do. It's a very tough start to Pac-12 play.
If they sweep both of these games, I'll be really excited about Husky basketball. It'll put Husky basketball on the radar.
And they really need that buzz, especially with the Seahawks just dominating everything else in
the
sports landscape right now.
And then talk more now about the players they don't have than the players they do have. So let's wrap things up by talking about a big event in TV.
Community is back.
Community is back with Dan Harmon.
The important thing is it's just nice to have Dean Pelton back in my life again. the official sitcom character of the Fabulous
Pelton. The official Dean of the Fabulous Pelton cast. Yeah. So last season of Community, I have vague memories of it. It's almost like I have changnesia about it.
I don't think it was that terrible.
They referenced it during the Community episode one, during the Community premiere of season five, and I didn't even know what they were referencing. Apparently Jeff went away and then came back.
Just like the finale, I think it was.
And they were assuming that it would be the series finale.
No, they knew that there was a chance of it coming back.
And so I thought that they did a really good job, though. Dan Harmon is amazing.
I mean, first off, the challenge is it's a school about community college. How do you keep it going fifth season?
That's not really that big of a deal, because really, community college only lasts for 2 years.
There's so many issues with it.
Right. So I was comparing earlier, I was talking to a friend of mine about this, who's a big Arrested Development fan, and I said that Dan Harmon is the Mitchell Hurwitz of Community.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
He's the guy. Right? The show shouldn't exist without him. Arrested Development wouldn't have come back for a fourth season without Mitchell Hurwitz.
I mean, it was weird last year because everything was the same, but it was, you know, it was kind of like a funhouse mirror quality. Everything was slightly distorted because it was all the same characters, but they weren't doing exactly the same things they would have been if Dan Harmon was writing the scripts.
There are these certain things that Dan Harmon puts into it, too. He's such a brilliant writer, right? And Dan Harmon, noted douchebag, right? I feel like I would get along with him.
Self-admitted.
Yeah. Where perhaps a drunk also, the best sitcom writers are. There are these little things that he sneaks into these episodes where he's foreshadowing all of the future episodes. It's this brilliant thing that Dan Harmon is able to do. And all of these other writers are not at his level. They don't understand these characters in the same way that he understands the characters. He doesn't understand the process for how they're supposed to develop in human beings. And basically with these two new episodes, which I highly recommend, he's rebooting the whole thing.
I agree with that. First off, were you making a human beings joke intentionally?
Yeah.
Okay. Second, I didn't think that the second episode of the season was very good. I thought the first episode was really good.
That was the Nick Cage episode?
Nick Cage, yes.
You didn't think it was very good?
It was weird. I mean, the ending was very odd.
You know what I saw? I was rewatching season one of Community earlier this week because I was so excited about Community coming back. And I want to have a few more thoughts on season four or season five, but they mentioned, like, the very first or second episode that we're not just here for these programs, psychology or blah, 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 or air conditioning repair. And then that ended up being a major part of the plot, I believe, 2 years later.
That is pretty impressive.
But Dan Harmon was foreshadowing it in the second episode.
Now, do you recall that I had to talk you into, like, in Community?
I hated Community.
I was all in from day one because, first off, noted University of Washington alum Joel McHale.
Yes.
Second off, a character named Pelton. That's right up my
alley. That's all you need. We didn't know who Donald Glover was at the time, but Glover being in there. Plus Allison Brie. I mean, what was I thinking?
I don't know. I was there. I was on that bandwagon early, and you're a bit jumped on it.
You're on everything before I am. But I thought it was really good that they acknowledged how strange last season was. Basically, just shushing it under the rug, but not completely ignoring it. I thought the line that was really good was when Troy, Donald Glover, says, "Doesn't this feel a little bit weird without?" And then he nods to his right and then says, assuming, basically talking about Pierce Hawthorne, Chevy Chase.
Yeah.
And it was like, "Doesn't this feel a little bit weird without magnitude?"
The self-referential jokes get me every single time.
I thought that was really good. And then referencing a season of Scrubs, which I'm not particularly aware of because I don't watch that show.
Yeah, season 9, I think.
But I thought it was really good to include that and mention, not just ignore that a character left, you know? To bring him back and to bring him back in the conversation and for the characters also. But I think it's going to be a really good season of the Community. Are you concerned about Donald Glover only being on 6 episodes?
I mean, I love Donald Glover, so yes. But I think that it can probably carry on without him.
I agree. You know, it was really interesting to see from the very early episodes how Donald Glover's character is transformed. Where in, like, the early seasons, he's, like, a thug. He's, like, trying to be cool all the time. And it was the process of him becoming friends with these people. And he's a full-on weirdo now.
Which I think they could explore at some point. I mean, all of them have changed quite a bit, I think.
But that was what the repilot was about, was basically, we're going to get back to what we started this as, right? So this season, I think we'll see a lot more of what Dan Harmon went into the show with the ideas of these characters as.
That'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah. And another thing that's happening, wait, any more thoughts on Community?
I don't think so.
It's a must-watch show from here on out.
I would agree.
Every week, and we may talk about it more, especially if there's a notable episode. That's the thing, is these first couple episodes were just reestablishing the whole culture of it. It wasn't about doing anything big or grandiose or claymation, but might we see a Paintball Part 3 this year, something like that, where they bring it back to the glory days?
I think so. I think that
there's going to be something big that's going to happen in the season, and it'll be like, whoa, Community is here. You know?
Community is back.
Yeah.
It'll be like the dunk contest every year. It's back.
I was thinking earlier, I'm excited to talk about the dunk contest in February. But also debuting, and I'm going to force you to watch this, this Sunday is the show Girls.
You're going to force me to watch it?
Yes.
Are there going to be any gynecological exams?
Mini. It'll be very uncomfortable for you. I thought last season of Girls, season 2 of Girls, was one of, I'm going to say this, even better than any season of Breaking Bad, was the best season of television I've ever watched.
Wow.
And it was highly criticized.
That is it. You've ever watched?
Yes.
You realize what you're saying there.
I went into those episodes with such excitement to watch them and left those episodes with so many feelings and thinking, this is such a brilliant show.
I mean, I don't know. I
have you ever watched an episode of it?
No.
You've got a lot of work to do, because you're going to have to catch up on Tuesday.
I think I've seen an SNL sketch parodying. Yeah. That's my main...
That's where you
That's
at.
My main interaction with girls.
I think it's a complicated thing, and I want to, throughout this time period, probably after the NFL season is over, explore why it's a show that gets criticized as heavily as it does, while also being a brilliant television show. I think it's such... Maybe the media is so white male-dominated that it's not able to get... And older white male dominated. I think that the, like, television media... But we'll talk about this later. But I think television media is 30 to 40-something white male dominated.
I mean, yeah.
It's crazy that there's a thing, television media, but it exists.
Maybe 25 to 40. I think it skews a little younger now.
But I'm excited for that coming back, and we're going to have to talk about that.
Yippee. All right, well... We can't close with any Jermaine Kearse stats this week, so I guess just thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Go Seahawks this weekend.
Go Hawks.